Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The purpose of my current visit to the United States at the invitation of Vice President Biden is to implement the important agreement of the two presidents and advance the China-U.S. cooperative partnership.
Until this week, most Americans never heard of China's Vice President Xi Jinping, who we just heard speaking through a translator. Now Mr. Xi is visiting the United States, and we're told he is China's president in waiting. But who is he? What will his rise mean for China? For America, for Jeremy Lin. No, forget Jeremy Lin. But let's talk with Stephen Orlins, president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations, a think tank that promotes U.S.-China political and business ties. He has a long history in business and diplomacy with China. Mr. Orlins, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure to be here.
And I gather you had lunch with Mr. Xi during this visit. What was the context of that lunch?
Well, there were two lunches. The first lunch I attended was hosted by Vice President Biden and Secretary Clinton with about 250 people in attendance from government, the business community, and the think tank community.
So that's not exactly lunch with Mr. Xi. You're somewhere in the ballroom.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the second lunch, the one yesterday, was one which the National Committee, my organization, hosted. And there were 600 people in the room. There was a small reception beforehand where I got the opportunity to spend some time with him, but then he gave a major speech which was broadcast both here and in China. But again, there were 600 people. People were able to have a direct view of him giving this speech and kind of, you know, get some sense of who he is.
I want to play you some examples of the Republican presidential hopefuls on the campaign trail in recent months. This is what cable TV politics watchers across America are hearing about China in debate after debate.
China's stolen our intellectual property, our designs, our patents, and know-how. It's hacked into our computers. It's manipulated its currency. I think you got to say we're going to label them a currency manipulator and apply tariffs if necessary.
You know, Mitt, I don't want to go to a trade war. I want to beat China. I want to go to war with China and make America the most attractive place in the world to do business.
I think we're going to have to find ways to dramatically raise the pain level for the Chinese cheating, both in the hacking side, but also on the stealing and intellectual property side. And I don't think anybody today has a particularly good strategy for doing that.
So, three different candidates at three different times. Mr. Orlins, do you think that paints an accurate picture of China or an overhyped, overparanoid picture?
Clearly overhyped and overparanoid, but it's a reflection of kind of the kind of discussion that is going on in the campaign today, that it's not only true of China, it's true of a broad range of issues, that the candidates are trying to oversimplify, not discuss nuance and appeal to a very narrow segment of the population. I'm always reminded of, kind of, was it Huey Long who had the about taxes? Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that guy behind the tree. This is don't blame you, don't blame me, blame that guy behind the tree, and that guy behind the tree in this case is China. You know, this demonization of China, given what's happened over the last 32 years, is really inappropriate for, I think, a U.S. presidential campaign.
Well, here, by contrast, is President Obama making nice with Xi at their joint appearance this week.
We believe that a strong and prosperous China is one that can help to bring stability and prosperity to the region and to the world.
So, President Obama... go ahead.
Brian, what you're not playing, though, is he also had some very tough direct criticism of China in the presence of Vice President Xi. So I would not say that during this visit that President Obama was making nice. In fact, at the lunch which Vice President Biden hosted, it was quite clear that the Vice President was addressing the domestic audience, the U.S. audience, in his toast, that he had a long list of issues which he criticized China about. So I don't think it's right to say that he was simply making nice to China.
Well, fair enough. And I was going to point out that the U.S. does have real issues with China. It's not just Republican candidate hyperbole. Vice President Biden was also talking tough this week on a laundry list of things, including currency manipulation, intellectual property theft, being obstructionist on Syria. And in fact, I want to play another montage of things that President Obama said in the Midwest yesterday, talking about the company Masterlock bringing some jobs back to America from China. Here again, the president.
Over the last few years, it's become more expensive to do business in countries like China instead of supplies from China. Today, you're selling products directly to customers in China. The cost of doing business here isn't too much different than the cost of doing business in places like China. Then why wouldn't you rather do it right here in the United States of America?
So, fair enough. He's also competing with China. He's also criticizing China. What do you think are the biggest issues that need to be dealt with?
Well, I think, you know, that they should be focusing on issues such as protection of U.S. intellectual property rights. I mean, that is clearly something that, you know, when you're higher up on the value-added chain, that a lot of U.S. business is based upon its intellectual property rights. And there is a problem in China, as there is in many developing countries, on protection of intellectual property rights. That's one. I think this focus on currency valuation is focusing on last year's issue. Combination of inflation and currency appreciation has brought the Chinese currency not totally in line, but up to a point where their current account surplus is a small percentage of GDP. We ask for it to be under 4%. It's now about 2%. So that is an issue which should drop, in fact, out of the discussion. Human rights remains an important issue. And I think the president, Governor Romney's editorial in today's New York Times suggests the president did not raise, and today's Wall Street Journal suggests the president did not raise human rights. It was clearly raised in private, and it was raised in public. That clearly is going to be an issue. You know, the competition going forward of, you know, the president talks about costs being the same. Well, they're not the same. That's actually not true. But more labor-intensive industries are now beginning to leave China and move to Vietnam and move to, you know, other places where cost of labor is actually cheaper. And that has been going on for decades. It didn't go to China. It went to Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and then to China. This started in the 70s, not recently. So clearly those are some of the issues which the campaigns, you know, how do we make America competitive is the right issue. The question is, how do we fix America? Does China cheat? Yes, there are areas where China needs to improve. You know, there are areas of opening China further to U.S. investment. You know, Vice President Xi, when he was here, made commitments to open, for instance, the auto insurance business to U.S. companies, which would have a real effect on a lot of insurance companies that are headquartered in New York and have operations in China.
How do they feel about geckos? Never mind. But there are – well, let me play you another clip of Vice President Xi through a translator on one of the issues that you brought up.
We will, in the light of China's national conditions, continue to take concrete and effective policies and measures to promote social fairness, justice, and harmony, and push forward China's cause of human rights.
Again, China's vice president visiting the United States this week, speaking there through a translator. But who believes him when he says, push forward China's cause for human rights, whatever that even means?
What the Chinese should be kind of trying to tell the American public is, you know, over the course of the last 32 years, since 1979, since reform and opening started, there has been tremendous progress in human rights. And I think the think tank community believes that is the case.
You believe that?
In the last 32 years, absolutely. That when I first moved to China in 1979, and people were not free to decide anything, they were not free to speak about anything, the freedoms that they have today are not what we have, nor are they what they should have. But has there been progress since 1979? The think tank community is in absolute agreement that there has been. Have the last few years, has there been retrogression in certain areas? I think the community would say there has been. When looked over kind of a longer period, there is progress. Over the shorter period, there is concern that there is not continuing progress. But it's always a mixed picture. There are areas where there is progress. You know, one thinks about the death penalty, which was very broadly applied. Now the Supreme Court has to approve all death penalty sentences, so it's somewhat of a check. But in terms of individual freedoms, the ability to organize, the ability to protest, there is clear, and civil society, there has clearly not been progress over the last 5 years. In fact, there probably is retrogression.
My guest is Stephen Orlins, president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations, and we can take your phone calls for him with Vice President Xi in the United States on the politics of it, Democratic and Republican parties kind of switching places on their positions vis-a-vis China, which Mr. Orlins has observed, and we'll ask him about that in a minute. Anything else you want to say about China, what the U.S. relationship with China should be politically, militarily, economically? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we will get to President Obama's proposal yesterday for what people are calling a global minimum tax, so that it's not so easy for U.S.-based multinational corporations to ship jobs overseas, take their profits overseas, but still keep their headquarters here and call themselves American companies. But before we take a break and then take some calls, Mr. Orlins, on the politics, the partisan politics, and for full disclosure, you have a background in the Democratic Party. You once, I gather, even ran for Congress as a Democrat from New York. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In 19, almost 20 years ago now, I was nominated by the Democratic Party for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. That's about half of Nassau County. And lost the election.
Who was the Republican then? Who did you
Peter
lose
King.
To? Oh, still Peter King,
office.
Even back then.
So yeah, you, Peter was his first run for Congress, and he won by a few thousand votes.
But you observed to my producer off the air yesterday that the two parties are switching sides on China, that it was previously the Republicans who were more China-friendly because they were the party of business, while the Democrats were the party harping on human rights. Now you think they've switched sides?
I think it's not really – I think it's the party in power that has to behave responsibly versus the party in opposition, and that you see the party in opposition as often criticizing China and the party in power needing to maintain that relationship for purposes of U.S. security. So it's really not a Republican-Democratic change. It's party in power versus party in opposition. So if you go back – you know, when the Republicans are out of power, they're critical of the China policy. When the Democrats are out of power, they're critical of the China policy. So it's less a Democratic-Republican difference than it is a in-power, out-of-power difference.
So going back a while again, the first President Bush was criticized by the Democrats for offering China most favored nation trade status, even though Tiananmen Square happened while he was president. And then President Clinton came in, and guess what? He offered China most favored nation trade status. In fact, I think it was under Clinton that that became permanent. Am I correct?
Correct, yes. The Congress passed the bill which gave China permanent most favored nation, so permanent national treatment.
We'll continue in a minute.
Yes.
So I take your point about the party in power seeming to want to play nice with China while the party out of power not. But when we continue in a minute, I will play the clip of what President Obama said in Milwaukee yesterday about a global minimum tax. And I also want to come back with you to that Mitt Romney op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today that you referenced, in which he seems to say he would be a very different kind of president toward China. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, President Obama yesterday in Milwaukee. Listen to this taxing proposal.
No American company should be able to avoid paying its fair share of taxes by moving jobs and profits overseas. So we've said from now on, every multinational company should have to pay a basic minimum tax. And every penny should go towards lowering taxes for companies that choose to stay and hire here in the United States of America. Give them a bigger tax break.
And with us still is my guest, Stephen Orlins. He is president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations. No accident, I think, that President Obama was making that proposal at the same time that the vice president of China, Mr. Xi, was campaigning, you might say, or making appearances elsewhere in the Midwest. Listeners, will take your calls on what China should want from the United States, what the U.S. should want from China. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. How did you react to that clip, Mr. Orlins? You've got a background on Wall Street. I know you were once the head of Lehman Brothers Asia in China. My sympathies about Lehman Brothers.
I left there 20 years ago before I ran for Congress.
Right, and in the Democratic Party, so you have some Democratic-leaning values. But what do you think about this idea of a global minimum tax?
But just one point, by the way, on my being a Democrat, that the National Committee is bipartisan. The chair of the National Committee was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and United States Trade Representative under the first under George Bush Sr. So in no way, shape, or form do we represent Democrats or Republicans.
Right.
We view ourselves as representing the American people.
Okay. So are you alarmed by that? As, you know, again, somebody with a background in finance, somebody who wants to keep relations good with China, do you see that as being aimed at China as well as domestic politics? How do you hear that proposal from the president?
You know, it sounds – I mean, it's not particularly aimed at China. You know, again, most U.S. companies that are in China are there to supply the Chinese market. We're not taking jobs and relocating them from the United States to China. We're putting people in China to be close to the customers. It's the fastest growing export market for the United States over the last decade.
But you
can't, it remains that way.
You can hardly buy a piece of clothing in the United States without it being made in China. You know the stories about Apple Computer that have been in the news.
Sure.
But
the question is, are those jobs left the United States? Most of those jobs left the United States in the 70s. And as I think I said before, Taiwan, first they went to Japan, then Taiwan, South Korea, and ultimately to China. So these are not jobs which are going to be coming back to the United States. They'll be moving elsewhere. As China becomes a more expensive place for manufacturing, they're going to move to other lower-cost places. I don't think most of those jobs are coming back to the United States. There are a few, and again, I think it's good for China to increase the value of its currency because that's going to increase our exports. It's going to increase, going to make American goods there cheaper, but American goods tend to be higher value goods than clothing or shoes or toys.
What is the context, as you see it, of master lock, which is one of the reasons that the president was in Milwaukee, highlighting the return of at least some jobs that were in China to the United States?
There are jobs. In other words, as I said, most of the jobs will not come back to the United States, but there are jobs which will come back because those goods are being distributed in the United States. That it's important, given the kind of the just-in-time manufacturing that exists today in virtually all industries, that you be close to your customer. So to the extent that these goods are being distributed and the labor component of them is not that high, Chinese labor costs are still substantially lower than American labor costs. So we're not going to see a massive increase in jobs back in the United States as China becomes more expensive. But are there examples? Absolutely.
So is the model slave labor?
No,
as
not
many,
a slave labor problem.
Many Americans see it, in effect, slave labor. I don't mean slavery in the old southern U.S. plantation sense, but, you know, the $2 a day worker without any environmental or, let's say, labor workplace standard, safety standards to speak of.
Well, clearly China, I mean, first of all, the cost, if you talk to businesses, the cost of manufacturing, the cost of Chinese labor is going up significantly. That wage rates are rising rapidly. You're seeing reports across the board of 20% increases. You couple that with the appreciation in the currency, and you're looking at, you know, the currency is going up roughly 6%, 8% a year. So you're seeing slave labor? It's not slave labor. Is there migrant labor? Yes, but migrant labor, and there are problems. Again, I don't want to sound like I'm saying that there are no problems. There are terribly serious problems in the manufacturing process, but a lot of this, people come from rural areas. They work in these factories, and they send enormous amounts of money home, and they take money home because they're making, you know, three or four times what they could make on the farm when they're at these factories, which is why over the last month we've seen, I think, 2.3 billion trips in China because it's been Lunar New Year. The factories close and the people go home. So it's raising their standard of living.
Bill in Great Neck, you're on WNYC. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi there. So you have some investments in China, I gather.
Yeah, I invested in an alternative energy company that produces wind power, solar power, geothermal. And it turns out that they lied about the numbers, and this is common, and the SEC is opened an investigation and is in discussions now with the powers to be over there, and there is a difficulty in the meeting of minds. They don't particularly want to reveal the true numbers because they say we are a sovereign nation and we don't have to do this, and it's created a horror. And as it stands right now, it looks like I've lost $500,000, but I'm not the only one. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars that have been ripped off because they see things differently than we do.
This was a publicly listed company that did a backdoor listing in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah, and the accounting has been rather problematic. It's a polite way to put it. Yes.
Yes.
That's been and clearly, the SEC, in order to encourage Chinese listings of this sort, the SEC, encouraged
people
to do it. They didn't look the other, but now they're clearly these accounting frauds have been quite serious, and there's a real crackdown coming.
Does Bill have any recourse to get his money back?
These companies are U.S. listed. Shareholder suits.
We are involved in a class action suit at this time.
Yep. Bill, thank you for your call. That's a fascinating, troubling story. Did you see, on a related note, the article in the New York Times this week, Mr. Orleans, about how business and government people from here who travel to China don't leave any information on their cell phones or computers? They take the batteries out even, or bring loaner machines over there because electronic business espionage is so rampant in China?
Yes, I saw the story.
Are you familiar with that as an issue?
Yes, familiar with that as an issue. And clearly there's there's significant monitoring of communication and business secrets need to be heavily encrypted, and one needs to take appropriate action. And that's, I would quote one of our directors, Ken Lieberthal, who's at Brookings, as saying he takes the battery out, takes a loaner computer. But clearly that is a problem, and one which the Obama administration is trying to address. That one of the issues that they addressed with Vice President Xi was this kind of the hacking and the cyber disputes between the United States and China. And it's, as this becomes more integral to kind of business around the world, it's going to be an increasingly important issue, and one which we need to address directly with China. So when I see Romney saying it was all pomp and circumstance, I kind of go, wait a minute, didn't we talk about all these issues with Vice President Xi, the guy who's going to become president? And isn't there an enormous value in that? So I looked at that editorial this morning, and I just said, I don't get it. I don't get it.
Well, it's political season. He also called Obama a near supplicant to Beijing in that Wall Street Journal editorial. But let me go further with that. Romney wrote about what he would do if he's elected president. He writes, unless China changes its ways, on day one of my presidency, I will designate it a currency manipulator and take appropriate counteraction. A trade war with China is the last thing I want, but I cannot tolerate our current trade surrender. You said before you think the currency issue is over because China...
It's not over, but it's certainly, we've seen nominal appreciation, above 10%, and then you you know, the real appreciation, you have to factor in the difference between Chinese inflation and U.S. inflation. So you've really seen it at about 20%.
And how about
their inflation is much higher than our inflation. So the question, I mean, is it still undervalued? I think the consensus among U.S. economists is it is, but you're not looking at, you know, we used to talk about, or the economists used to talk about 20-30%. Now you're talking about maybe 10%, and the trend of the RMB and China's inflation rate being greater than ours, by the time he becomes president, we may see an equalization. The other is, you know, as a percentage, we used to say China needs a current account surplus of less than 4% of GDP. It's now 2% of GDP. They don't, their reserves over the last 3 months have been decreasing. That from $3.2 trillion, it's not going up anymore. It's decreasing. Well, that tells you that you're getting some level of balance, so that it's kind of, it's closing the barn door after the cow has left. I mean, it just seems to me fighting a war of 2-3 years ago. So I don't agree with it. And to start a trade war, you know, is I would hope that if he's elected president, that between the election and the inauguration, that he would adopt more sensible policies, which is often the case.
Peter in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. My question for the guest is, I'm involved with a company by the name of Scuderi based in Massachusetts that has patented all over the world this new sort of a swing on the internal combustion engine. It's going to be brought to the U.S. very, very shortly and out in an IPO. But my question is there really any way to protect even something as innovative as this from being stolen in China, either intellectual property or infringement on patents?
It's patentable in the United States?
I'm sorry?
You have a patent in the United States?
We have patents not only in the United States, but all over the world,
China. I would register the patent in China. We've seen Motorola. We've seen other companies, U.S. companies, bring successful patent suits in China.
And you've actually been able to protect their patents and their intellectual property by doing that.
There have been successful suits. Whether, you know, again, I don't know enough about your individual business to say, you know, should you, because obviously in applying for a patent, you're going to be providing a certain amount of information that you may prefer not to provide. So you have to, you have to weigh the protection you're going to get. But again, we are now seeing successful suits by U.S. companies over patent infringement. And you also have the, you know, if your patent is properly registered, you not only could bring suit in China, but should any of the goods come back to the United States, you can block them coming back to the United States through a suit in the U.S. court. But you have to weigh what you need to disclose versus the protection that you get. But talk to the folks at Motorola, and there are several. Maybe Apple brought a successful suit. A few major U.S. companies have won suits. And what's happening is China knows that to create what it calls its innovation society, it needs to protect patents. So they're going to do this to protect their own. They're going to protect us in the process. But now, when I first went there, it was like 90% of the patent suits were brought by foreigners. This is 25, 30 years ago when I was a lawyer in China. Today, the overwhelming majority are brought by Chinese against Chinese. So they're going to have a better patent system because they need it for their own purposes. Should we as the U.S. government continue to push the Chinese on this? Absolutely. But they're going to fix it for their own reasons.
Peter, thank you for your call and good luck with your business and your invention. We're almost out of time with Stephen Orlins, president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations, which obviously works for good U.S.-China relations. We've been talking virtually the whole time about America's grievances with China, what the United States wants or should want from China going forward. What does the United States want from us? What message is Vice President Xi giving to President Obama on this trip?
Well, first and foremost, you know, don't make us the enemy that we're not, that we are not, you know, that kind of our complementary interests far outweigh our conflicting interests, and we should find ways to build on our complementary interests and reduce our conflicting interests. That's one. terms of the trade deficit. He's very specific. He said, you restrict exports of U.S. high technology goods from China to the United States. If you're so worried about the trade deficit, why not reduce those restrictions? Investment, you know, China's now sitting on $3.2 trillion of reserves. It has about $1.1 trillion of U.S. treasuries. It would like to convert some of that into direct investment in the United States. There is a perception in China that we don't welcome, that the, especially the federal government, state governments and local governments, they view quite differently, but the federal government seeks to limit Chinese investment into the United States, and they point to several examples. So he is saying, you know, allow us to invest in America, allow us to create jobs in America, allow us to use these reserves in a productive way. So I think those were very much his messages. You know, there are things that you can do that help our relationship and that help America.
And I imagine that he has to look tough on America for his own domestic political purposes before he gets elevated to the presidency of China later this year as expected, just as the United States politicians have to look tough on China. Do you think he passed that test?
Yes, he did.
How?
And you're right, your analysis is absolutely right. He needed to, you know, he could not be seen, just as Obama and Biden can't be seen as accommodating China, he cannot be seen as accommodating America. And I think he's, you know, tough on Tibet. I mean, we have a real, we have very different views on how China should be treating Tibet and Tibetan monks. You know, he's tough on that. Had, you know, tough on Taiwan, tough on the normal range of issues that the Chinese leadership addresses when they're in America. So, yes, I think, and I watched the Chinese media coverage of his visit last night, and it was portraying him as standing firm with America.
Okay, you got to tell me before you go, did he say anything about Jeremy Lin?
He didn't, but I'm told he's a real NBA fan.
No kidding.
And I'm told he would love to go to a Lakers game when he's going to Los Angeles today, and he would love to go to a Lakers game, but I don't know if he's going to be able to fit it in his schedule.
Maybe go home and, as a good politician, try to take credit. He said, look, I finally come and do a tour of the United States, and what happens? They have their biggest Chinese-American cultural icon
right. In
the history of the United States.
Yeah. By the way, I want one other thing when you look at the speech is that, you know, this story of this widow who went to China to go to the birthplace, you know, not the birthplace, but where her late husband had grown up, and how Vice President Xi kind of arranged for this. It was quite a touching, interesting story, which was not what most Chinese leaders do when they come here. It was a story that was, I think, successfully humanized the man who's going to be China's leader in 12 months. It was very interesting, and I encourage all the listeners to go and look at that portion of the speech, which was not what I would call a traditional part of Chinese leadership speech.
So in that light, and I really have to go in 20 seconds, but what do you think the odds are of him being the Gorbachev if he becomes the president of China?
Don't know. I mean, he's got a very interesting background. You know, somebody lived in the elite, sent down to the farm, and then made it back up to the very top. Very interesting background.
Stephen Orlins, president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations. Thank you very much for an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we continue our series on parenting styles around the world with Mei-Ling Hopgood, author of How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm. Today, autonomy versus family obligations in different cultures. Stay with us.